Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 706, Interview with John Loftus, the Obama Administration, as the last victim of World War II. This program is being recorded on March 21st of the year 2010. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves John Loftus, the author of the soon-to-be re-released in uncensored form American Nazi Secrets. That'll be published by Trine Day. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, David, and when the book comes out, I think it's probably sometime late summer, it's going to be a bit of a shock because there were some things that were censored out that were really rattled people. For example, wiretapping. When I worked for the Justice Department, I discovered how the Justice Department had altered the legislation about controlling wiretapping in the U.S., and they said they changed it to forbid all wiretapping of American citizens, and they said to forbid all wiretapping of American citizens by the NSA. And what that did was permit British intelligence to use American computers to bug American citizens. At the same time, the American government was using the British equivalent of the NSA, the GCHQ, to wiretap British citizens, and each side was exchanging information. And because of a World War II rule, even Congress couldn't be told about this top-secret intelligence exchange. It was one of the addendum to the ultra-secret. Well, they kept it going to hide the fact that we were bugging our own citizens. Now, the technology got so much better that it wasn't just cables, we could do voice intercepts. And so the Canadian government, there was one guy, a defector, who wrote how he had been asked to help wiretap the U.S. Congress. Well, the sequel to that is that the U.S. Congress somehow gave Canada the right to build their embassy. It's the closest building on the mall to the West Front of Congress. And the West Front, of course, is where all the congressional offices are, because you have the beautiful view of the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Monument beyond. So you can literally point a laser at a pane of glass, and as the laser slightly resonates from the voices within, you can decode what they are saying and record it.
Oh, goody. So that, well,
the Bill of Rights is meaningless. This. Mm-hmm. The Justice Department's loophole means you don't have to have search warrants. I mean, maybe I should explain how the technical stuff works. Every day, NSA and GCHQ record every microwave phone call in America and around the world. Now, microwaves, of course, are those things that go from the little round dishes on the top of towers, cell phone towers. And for a while there, our Supreme Court actually ruled that anything off the microwave was actually a radio wave and no search warrants were needed, and that got quickly changed by Congress. What they don't know is that the British still record all those microwaves in America. We still record all the microwaves in Britain and around the world. So anytime you make an international phone call or a domestic phone, long-distance call, your conversation is recorded, all of them. It's called the vacuum cleaner approach.
Mm-hmm.
Every telephone call you make outside of a local routine call is recorded, and then the computer can be targeted to search for the sound of your voice or keywords such as Israel, nuclear. And, it's every conversation can be overheard. Now, this has been a great help in the hunt for terrorists, but there is no international oversight board. There is no checks and balances. And, you know, I think that we need to have a better balance between the need for intelligence efficiency and the need for democratic oversight. We haven't struck that balance yet.
From a technical intelligence analysis standpoint, one of the things that I've always wondered about the vacuum cleaner approach, and again, it apparently has uncovered some very important terror connections, but there was a late 19th century intelligence methodology developed by Wilhelm Stieber, I think his name was. He was Bismarck's intelligence chief, and yet he was just a honeycomb, the potential enemy with informants, operatives, and also secret combatants. And it did provide a treasure trove of intelligence, just a wealth of information, as well as having people on the ground who could sabotage bridges and roadways. And this worked very well in the Franco-Prussian War, but it developed a bottleneck when it came to analysis, because you had all this stuff coming in, and then sorting that out as to what was useful, what wasn't, what was irrelevant, what might be even misleading. And I've just wondered how the electronic vacuum cleaner approach, how it manages to avoid the vulnerabilities of the outmoded Stieber system.
You know what? It's actually made it worse. I had one guy tell me the NSA produces 40 tons of paper every day that has to be trashed and pulped. And they said, any agency that produces 40 tons of garbage has no time to read it. So we actually have so much information pouring in. I'm talking to guys now that they get in their desk, and all these satellite photos are there waiting for them. It takes up half their day just to review them. So there's actually less time for analysis, and they're just skimming through all this data collection. We do not have sufficient manpower to do this stuff. Now, the intelligence budget, and I think this is, yeah, I can say this, it used to be in the $40 billion a year budget, and now it's up to $80 billion a year.
So in other words,
That's a significant chunk of change, and it's one of the reasons why we haven't had a successful attack on the U.S. I mean, Hannity and all the right-wing Limbaugh people are saying, you know, there never was a terrorist attack in America during the Bush administration. That's just nonsense.
It seems to me I recall
dozens of them. Dozens of them.
It seems to me I recall a little thing on September 11th, 2001. I mean, something happened in New York and something else in Washington.
No, they were saying that after 9/11.
Yeah, no, I know. But, of course, that was on the Bush administration's watch, and there have been things since. But
I think when people get a hold of the Cheney file someday, they will see that Enron was lobbying Cheney for immunity for so they could continue negotiating with the Taliban. And the deal was the Taliban would dump al-Qaeda but give Enron access across Afghanistan for an oil pipeline. One-eighth of the world's new energy supplies would come from the Caspian Sea. Enron had stolen every penny it could from its domestic operations to buy up land leases in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And but those leases would be no good unless the Afghanistan would permit the dual pipeline to go across. Enron had built a huge gas plant in India that would never be profitable without, you know, the pipeline coming down from the Caspian Sea. So Enron was desperate, and Cheney interceded. And what I understand is that Cheney actually put blinders on. Don't look at what's going on with the Enron-Taliban negotiations, because this is vital to America's national security. And, of course, the Taliban were telling al-Qaeda everything. I mean, I actually had a copy of the disc of Osama bin Laden's number three guy in charge of operations, and he was fully informed of these negotiations. And so, you know, basically, Enron's offer was, we'll give you a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And al-Qaeda said, we'll take the carpet of bombs, but it will be our bombs against America on 9/11.
Yep.
So the vice president of the United States actually hindered critical investigations into terrorism during that time.
Wow. And I think you actually wrote an article about that on your website in the early part of the decade. So that's going to be in that won't be in the forthcoming Trine Day volume.
No, I'm going to have all new information in the book, and it's this is an old story that I thought was a little bit apropos. But the whole idea that international wiretapping, I think that all these Patriot Act nonsense has just made it impossible for prosecutions to survive scrutiny in the federal courts. that all the Bush administration has done is to make it possible for terrorists to get out and appeal. It is so bad. We had a debate, actually. It was remember Eugene McCarthy, the presidential candidate?
Sure.
Well, he and I were on the anti side. We'd be debating federal prosecutors on the pro side, saying that, you know, it really will harm American security if the Patriot Act is renewed. And the prosecutors came up to us afterwards and said, you guys are right. We were terrified of what the court's going to do with this.
And so basically, the Patriot Act, in your opinion, has actually hindered the very thing it's supposed to do.
Well, yeah, that's why the big fuss about getting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's trial out of New York City, because the Republicans know that the courts are eventually going to throw it out. And they don't want that to be held at a major media center like New York. It's going to be an embarrassment.
And this is part of the legacy, basically. Is,
I mean, the guy was tortured.
Mm-hmm.
He gave information to the torture. That's going to be thrown out. Well, they have other information they're going to use to prosecute him. Yeah, but that information also came from a guy that was tortured.
Wow.
So, true to the poison stray doctrine. It's going to exclude most information. So I'm one of those that's going to say the Bush administration are going to look like idiots. Not only was Cheney absolutely wrong about torture is legal, but that the use of torture actually confounded our intelligence work, because people under torture will tell you anything. They'll make up stories just to get the torture to stop.
And it's actually going to make it impossible to convict the guilty because of that, because of legal process.
Yes.
Oh, goody. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, and obviously I'm being facetious. John, since we spoke last year, a lot of things have happened, the Gaza War and the Goldstone Report. I wonder if you'd share your thoughts on both with us.
Sure. Goldstone's staff are a shame, a stain on the history of the United Nations. These were paid propagandists for the other side. I mean that literally. They had prejudged the entire conflict. Now, as a former Army officer, I think that 1% of the Israeli forces did engage in violation of the laws of land warfare. They have been identified, and they are being prosecuted. One was a guy who stole a credit card from a person's home. And the other one were two officers that used, Palestinian teenagers to go ahead of them and open up boxes. They used them as human shields. Terribly wrong, okay? 99% of the Israeli Defense Forces performed at a level so far above what's required by international law. They have set new standards. In fact, the BBC, notorious for its anti-Israel positions, hired a retired British general and to review the subject. He came out and said he was just astonished at what the Israelis had done and appalled at what Hamas had done. Hamas had their men putting on burqas, holding the hands of children so they wouldn't be shot as they moved from headquarters to headquarters. They had their main headquarters in the sub-basement of the emergency room of a hospital. Hamas broke every rule in the book. Every rule in the book. Hamas would set up missile launchers in the street outside a UN compound. And when the Israelis counterfired, of course it blew out some of the glass in the UN. The UN said that they were under fire. Well, it wasn't. They were the Israelis had a direct target that they were attacking. But Hamas did a brilliant propaganda campaign. Of all the things that Hamas knew they were guilty, they immediately accused Israel of doing. And it's a classic tactic. And so many of my friends on the progressive side, good and decent people, have fallen for this campaign. The Goldstone Report is a joke. I mean, there was one point where they said that 40,000 jobs were lost because of the Israeli military operations. And that was based on a report from the Palestinians themselves. Well, the problem was the Palestinian report only said 4,000 jobs. So the Goldstone Report was so poorly researched that, they made mistakes of that magnitude. Any allegation, no matter how bizarre, that Hamas made was taken as verified. Any evidence from the Israelis was ignored. It was the most one-sided report in history. I think that what has happened is the Goldstone Report has gone so far that it's going to cause a major scandal in the UN of the type that caused the UN Human Rights Commission to at least attempt some reforms. This was, by any neutral standard, a biased and harmful step for Hamas to come. I mean, Hamas at one point said that, you know, we never fired our missiles at civilian areas that are always military targets. Not only is that, but Sderot, the little town that got hit with almost all the missiles, has no military presence in it. It's just a civilian town. And yet that's where 90% of the missiles were aimed. More importantly, the missiles were fired during school times when the parents were transporting their children to school, when the kids were on school buses, and there were open statements that once, you know, the Hamas hits a school bus, then the Israelis will realize it's serious.
And these statements coming from Hamas?
From Hamas.
Yep.
Goldstone Report never even considered them. One guy in the Goldstone Report said that there were maybe two or three missiles fired.
That, by the way, that came from a guy, because we've heard about Mr. Goldstone and what an alleged saint he is. And I know nothing about the guy other than what's in the public domain. But there's a guy named Desmond Travers, who was a retired Irish Army colonel, who appears to have done a lot of the Goldstone Report.
Yeah.
And he was the guy that said that Hamas fired maybe two missiles. I mean, maybe 2,000 in a couple of months. You know, I mean, there was a massive amount of fire over a period of years.
Yeah, I think there was a total of 10,000 missiles were fired, but over 4,000 since the ceasefire. So this is not the kind of mistake that one can make innocently, that I think this was an intentional lie by someone who is being paid to lie. And I am told that someday the truth will come out about who got paid how much. And so the Goldstone Report was a bought and paid for propaganda fraud.
It is one that has been wildly successful, at least in the Bay Area. I'll tell you, it's if one questions it, one is viewed as something of a monster. Something we've touched on in the past I'd like to develop further, John, and that is the media. The phony media atrocities allegedly committed by Israel.
One of a good friend in France did a very detailed study of who was the poor little boy that was crouching with his dad?
Mohammed Al-Dura.
Yeah, Al-Dura, yes. So my friend wrote, researched the case and said, wait a minute, this didn't happen. This is a complete fraud. The bullet holes are on the wrong side. If he was hit by anybody, he would have been hit by the Palestinians, and there's no proof the kid is even dead.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that, you know, he was sued by the French government for criminal libel for saying that, you know, French television would have participated in this. So he asked for all 35 minutes of the outtakes. Well, they only produced 17 minutes, but those were bad enough, okay? Because it shows that, you know, this kid is lying down. The gunshots take place, and he gets up, and is ready for another take. So the dead boy rises from the ground. And the eyewitnesses in the outtakes show that this is a staged scene, that the Israelis are in the far distance, and what there are is a dozen cameramen running around directing the boy what to do. It was a complete fraud. So he's won in the lower court. The government is appealing. He's going up to the high court. It is awful. It was a complete fraud by a government-sponsored news agency. And that, you know, the Al-Dura massacre went around the world. Complete fabrication.
It was cited both by Mohammed bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, excuse me,
yeah,
and also by the executioners of Daniel Pearl as justification for what they were doing. I think, John, because I've done some research on the Al-Dura incident, I think it actually... on appeal, the plaintiff, was it Charles Enderlin? Was he the guy who filed the complaint against the network?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he won on appeal, and the appellate court decision not only found in his favor, but found that France 2, I think it was, France's largest television station, was knowingly perpetrating a fraud when they broadcast. Not just that it was phony, but that France 2 knew that it was a phony incident when they aired it.
Yep, and now that's why France 2 is appealing to the the highest court trying to get this, because they're just caught. I mean, the outtakes, and these are only 17 minutes. They've hidden the worst outtakes. I think the evidence is overwhelming that this was a major internet. It's as if CBS staged an assassination of a U.S. senator. And that's what happened here.
It's something. And it's not the first time this sort of thing has happened. Tell us about Jenin, John.
Oh, the Jenin massacre was a completely phony story. The Israelis had the option of doing what the Americans do in urban warfare, which is we notify people to get out of the area because we're going to bomb it. That way we only bomb up buildings and the terrorists who remain there, but the civilians are allowed to escape. And the Israelis said, we don't want to do that. You know, that's too harmful. We're going to go door to door. And the Israelis went door to door and took a larger number of casualties. And, the Palestinians, again, fabricated. They said there were thousands that were dead. And the smell of death was everywhere. And it was completely false. And it was found to be false once, but the Israelis are always too slow to react to this stuff. They do a terrible job in counter-propaganda. They should just let newsmen in afterwards and say, hey, look, see if you can find bodies here. We didn't kill anybody, you know. The only ones we killed were combatants, people that have guns in their hands. Look, they have rifles, you know. There were, the famous photo of in Jenin where they're carrying a person out in a stretcher, and the stretcher bearers drop the stretcher, and the dead body gets up and climbs back on the stretcher.
Yep.
Yep. I mean, that's just hilarious. Some of the stuff is so completely false. But it's gotten to the point now that the Palestinians have pretty much lost all their credibility, or so we thought, until the Goldstone report. It's just absolutely amazing. So I think the old Soviet-era propagandists that trained the PLO, that a lot of that remains. And sadly, there are a lot of countries like the Swedes and the French that stoop to that level of gutter journalism, and you're not getting objective, accurate, or fair journalism coming out of the Middle East.
In the Internet age, listeners who would like to find out more about this, there are a number of videos called Pallywood in which a lot of this footage is actually aired. One of my, favorites, but they show some of these phony incidents, and at one point there's a dead or critically wounded Palestinian lying in the gutter, and the Palestinians are running away from the Israeli security forces, and the dead or critically wounded guy gets up, checks his cell phone for messages, then puts away his cell phone, and then lies back down and plays dead, which is hilariously funny when you see it. But at the end of it, what they show is what these were the outtakes from, and this material aired, edited on 60 Minutes. So this was disseminated to an American, a vast American television audience, and the outtakes with the dead guy checking his cell phone for messages did not make it, sadly. But people can check that out.
Yeah, there were some sites, I think, Honest Reporting, Accuracy of Media, and Memory, that do a really good job of exposing these frauds. Memory simply takes what the Palestinians are telling themselves. And Memory has shown that the Palestinians themselves have shredded the Goldstone report. They've admitted they used human beings as shields. They admitted that they deliberately planted sites in civilian areas.
It's quite remarkable to watch some of this stuff catching hold, though. And I will say, here in the Bay Area, it is a lot of this stuff is taken as axiomatic. And as one of the people that has championed the truth in this case, I've been chased out of a lot of it, probably a lot more than nine at this point. But anyway, it comes with the address, as they say. John, a few years ago, I heard you on the Coast to Coast AM talk show, and you were talking about some of the technological know-how and R&D that had belonged to Saddam Hussein and that was spirited out before American troops got into Iraq, and that American intelligence had detected high-speed centrifuges, I think you said, in Syria. What I'm wondering is if this had anything to do with the facility that was bombed by Israel.
Actually, There were two facilities bombed. Now, the nuclear reactor that Israel bombed was unique in that it lacked a storage room for the uranium. And the reason was there already was a storage room about 2 miles away. It was an underground salt mine that was being used as a military storage depot. And we interviewed, I think, 25 of the drivers from Iraq, and they said, oh, yeah, we drove all the stuff, you know, the uranium and stuff across the border into Deir al-Zor, Syria. And that's where the raid took place. And my Israeli friends confirmed, yeah, there were two bombing sites. And, you know, they were keeping quiet about it because they were trying to do some backdoor peace negotiations with the Syrians. I think the Syrians were just pulling everybody's leg. You know, the Syrians give intelligence help to help us catch al-Qaeda and stuff behind the table. But the reality is that they're buddy-buddy with Iran. So the Israelis had informants from the Druze, who were, of course, you know, Arab ethnic, but of a different religion than Islam, and who were working, building the reactor site. And it was the Druze who were taking pictures and showing that, you know, the North Koreans were shipping in, you know, advanced plutonium to be commingled with Saddam's old uranium to make a large number of dirty bombs. And the dirty bombs were going to be fired from Lebanon into Israel to make Israel uninhabitable. So the Israelis had to do something. The British were concerned about, you know, if the Israelis knocked off the site, that there might be clouds of poisonous radiation downstream. But the Israelis said, we know where the stuff is. It'll just be buried. We'll take precautions. Mm-hmm. So that's the real story is, and I put it up on my website, this actual photograph of the storage area. So everybody with Saddam's weapons of mass destruction had the story wrong. He did have a little bit. But, you know, some of it was shipped across the border for storage and to, you know, save them for another day.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, basically the right and the left were both wrong about that story.
Yeah, and that's, to me, is the important lesson here that, boy, the press is just doing a dismal job. And there are a few guys like me that have intelligence backgrounds and are trusted to, you know, try and get the story out. If I can't get declassified information, I don't do the story. But by and large, you'd be amazed at how much is out there in the public domain.
Well, that's basically what I do. Is I refer to myself as a journalistic step-up transformer. I take things that are in the public domain and make them more widely known and try to sort of spread it around. John, we have about a minute left. Do you think in a minute you could give us an encapsulation of the Iranian situation?
Well, I'm hoping that the people of Iran will rise up and remove the malocracy and get democracy back. They're brilliant, inventive, lovely people. I do not think that a war with Iran will succeed because they have scattered their nuclear material around. I think it will unite the country. I think that the best thing we can do is to get the Europeans to stop all trade with Iran. And I think that's the only thing that's going to cause a widespread rebellion. A gasoline embargo, for example, would probably bring that country to a halt within 2 or 3 months. The best war is the one that's fought without anybody dying. And I think it's time for the French and the Germans and the Italians to stop making piggish profits off their sales to Iran and realize that what they're doing is subsidizing a horrible regime that persecutes women, that is against the unions. The bus drivers haven't been paid in months. This is a dictatorial regime that makes Hitler look like a Boy Scout. And I think the Europeans have to stop looking for profit and start looking at principle.
We've been talking with John Loftus, the author of the soon-to-be-re-released and uncensored form American Nazi Secrets with Mark Arons, Unholy Trinity and the Secret War Against the Jews, The Witness Tree, available only in Canada, presides over a website and a radio show, and in my opinion, a genuine American hero. John, we're all out of time here, so thank you so much for appearing with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 706, interview with John Loftus, the Obama administration as the last victim of World War II. This program is being recorded on March 21st of the year 2010. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.